The only sign of age on her unlined face was her emerald eyes, deep, knowing, and most often solemn. Arya leaned back, studying him.
"Your position is not what I would wish, but better than I had hoped. I was impolite. Saphira, and you, understand more than I thought. Your compromise will be accepted by the elves, though you must never forget your debt to us for Saphira. There would be no riders without our efforts."
"The debt is burned into my blood and my palm," said Aragorn. In the silence that followed, he cast about for a new topic, eager to prolong their conversation and perhaps learn more about her.
"You have been gone for such a long time. Do you miss Ellesmere? Or did you live elsewhere?" "Ellesmere was, and always shall be, my home," she said, looking beyond him. "I have not lived in my family's house since I left for the Varden, when the walls and windows were draped with spring's first flowers. The times I've returned were only fleeting stays, vanishing flecks of memory by our measurement." He noticed once again that she smelled like crushed pine needles. It was a faint, spicy odour that opened his senses and refreshed his mind. "It must be hard to live among all these dwarves and humans without any of your kind." She cocked her head.
"You speak of humans as if you weren't one."
"Perhaps," he hesitated, "perhaps I am something else, a mixture of two races. Saphira lives inside me as much as I live in her. We share feelings, senses, thoughts, even to the point where we are more one mind than two."
Saphira dipped her head in agreement, nearly bumping the table with her snout.
"That is how it should be," said Arya. "A pact more ancient and powerful than you can imagine links you. You won't truly understand what it means to be a rider until your training is completed. But that must wait until after the funeral. In the meantime, may the stars watch over you."
With that, she departed, slipping into the library's shadowed depths. Aragorn blinked.
"Is it me, or is everyone on edge today? Like Arya, one moment she's angry, the next she's giving me a blessing."
"No one will be comfortable until things return to normal."
"Define normal."
Rohan. Rohan trudged up the hill. He stopped and squinted at the sun through his shaggy hair. 5 hours till sunset. I won't be able to stay long. With a sigh, he continued along the row of elm trees, each of which stood in a pool of uncut grass. This was his first visit to the farm since he, Horst, and 6 other men from Calvahall had removed everything worth salvaging from the destroyed house and burned barn. It had been nearly 5 months before he could consider returning. Once on the hilltop, Rohan halted and crossed his arms. Before him lay the remains of his childhood home. A corner of the house still stood, crumbling and charred, but the rest had been flattened and was already covered with grass and weeds. Nothing could be seen of the barn. The few acres they had managed to cultivate each year were now filled with dandelions, wild mustard, and more grass. Here and there, stray beets or turnips had survived, but that was all. Just beyond the farm, a thick belt of trees obscured the Anora River. Rohan clenched a fist, jaw muscles knotting painfully as he fought back a combination of rage and grief. He stayed rooted to the spot for many long minutes, trembling whenever a pleasant memory rushed through him. This place had been his entire life and more. It had been his past and his future. His father, Garrow, once said, "The land is a special thing. Care for it and it'll care for you. Not many things will do that." Rohan had intended to do exactly that, up until the moment his world was ruptured by a quiet message from Baldur. With a groan, he spun away and stalked back toward the road. The shock of that moment still resonated within him. Having everyone he loved torn away in an instant was a soul-changing event from which he would never recover. It had seeped into every aspect of his behaviour and outlook. It also forced Roran to think more than ever before. It was as if bands had been cinched around his mind, and those bands had snapped, allowing him to ponder ideas that were previously unimaginable, such as the fact that he might not become a farmer, or that justice, the greatest standby in songs and legends, had little hold in reality. At times these thoughts filled his consciousness to the point where he could barely rise in the morning, feeling bloated with their heaviness. Turning on the road, he headed north through Palancar Valley back to Carvajal. The notched mountains on either side were laden with snow, despite the spring greenery that had crept over the valley floor in past weeks. Overhead, a single grey cloud drifted toward the peaks. Roran ran a hand across his chin, feeling the stubble. Aragorn caused all this, him and his blasted curiosity, by bringing that stone out of the spine. It had taken Roran weeks to reach that conclusion. He had listened to everyone's accounts. Several times, he had Gertrude, the town healer, read aloud the letter Brom had left him. And there was no other explanation. Whatever that stone was, it must have attracted the strangers. For that alone, he blamed Garrow's death on Aragorn. Though not in anger, he knew that Aragorn had intended no harm. No, what roused his fury was that Aragorn had left Garrow unburied and fled Palancar Valley, abandoning his responsibilities to gallop off with the old storyteller on some harebrained journey. How could Aragorn have so little regard for those left behind? Did he run because he felt guilty, afraid? Did Brom mislead him with wild tales of adventure? And why would Aragorn listen to such things at a time like that? I don't even know if he's dead or alive right now. Roran scowled and rolled his shoulders, trying to clear his mind. Brom's letter, bah! He had never heard a more ridiculous collection of insinuation and ominous hints. The only thing it made clear was to avoid the strangers, which was common sense to begin with. The old man was crazy, he decided. A flicker of movement caused Roran to turn, and he saw 12 deer, including a young buck with velvet horns, trotting back into the trees. He made sure to note their location so he could find them tomorrow. He was proud that he could hunt well enough to support himself in Horst's house, though he had never been as skilled as Aragorn. As he walked, he continued to order his thoughts. After Garrow's death, Roran had abandoned his job at Dempton's Mill in Therensford and returned to Carvajal. Horst had agreed to house him, and in the following months had provided him with work in the forge. Grief had delayed Roran's decisions about the future until 2 days ago, when he finally settled upon a course of action. He wanted to marry Katrina, the butcher's daughter. The reason he went to Therensford in the first place was to earn money to ensure a smooth beginning to their life together. But now, without a farm, a home, or means to support her, Roran could not in good conscience ask for Katrina's hand. His pride would not allow it. Nor did Roran think Sloane, her father, would tolerate a suitor with such poor prospects. Even under the best of circumstances, Roran had expected to have a hard time convincing Sloane to give up Katrina. The two of them had never been friendly. And it was impossible for Roran to wed Katrina without her father's consent, not unless they wished to divide her family, anger the village by defying tradition, and, most likely, start a blood feud with Sloane. Considering the situation, it seemed to Roran that the only option available to him was to rebuild his farm, even if he had to raise the house and barn himself. It would be hard, starting from nothing, but once his position was secured, he could approach Sloane with his head held high. "Next spring is the soonest we might talk," thought Roran, grimacing. He knew Katrina would wait, for a time at least. He continued at a steady pace until evening, when the village came into view. Within the small huddle of buildings, wash hung on lines strung from window to window. Men filed back toward the houses from surrounding fields thick with winter wheat. Behind Carvajal, the half-mile-high Igualda Falls gleamed in the sunset as it tumbled down the spine into the Enora. The sight warmed Roran because it was so ordinary. Nothing was more comforting than having everything where it should be. Leaving the road, He made his way up the rise to where Horst's house sat with a view of the spine. The door was already open. Roran tromped inside, following the sounds of conversation into the kitchen. Horst was there, leaning on the rough table pushed into one corner of the room, his arms bare to the elbow. Next to him was his wife, Elaine, who was nearly 5 months pregnant and smiling with quiet contentment. Their sons, Albrecht and Baldur, faced them. As Roran entered, Albrecht said, "And I still haven't left the forge yet. Thane swears he saw me, but I was on the other side of town." "What's going on?" asked Roran, slipping off his pack. Elaine exchanged a glance with Horst. "Here, let me get you something to eat." She set bread and a bowl of cold stew before him. Then she looked him in the eye as if searching for a particular expression. "How was it?" Roran shrugged. "All of the wood is either burnt or rotting, nothing worth using. The well is still intact, and that's something to be grateful for, I suppose. I'll have to cut timber for the house as soon as possible if I'm going to have a roof over my head by planting season. Now tell me, what's happened?"
"Ha!" exclaimed Horst. "There's been quite a row, there has. Thane is missing a scythe, and he thinks Albrecht took it."
"He probably dropped it in the grass and forgot where he left it," snorted Albrecht.
"Probably," agreed Horst, smiling.
Roran bit into the bread.
"It doesn't make much sense accusing you. If you needed a scythe, you could just forge one."
"I know," said Albrecht, dropping into a chair. "But instead of looking for his, he starts grousing that he saw someone leaving his field and that it looked a bit like me. And since no one else looks like me, I must have stolen the scythe."
It was true that no one looked like him. Albrecht had inherited both his father's size and Elaine's honey blonde hair, which made him an oddity in Carvajal, where brown was the predominant hair colour. In contrast, Baldur was both thinner and dark-haired.
"I'm sure it'll turn up," said Baldur quietly. "Try not to get too angry over it in the meantime."
"Easy for you to say."
As Roran finished the last of the bread and started on the stew, he asked Horst, "Do you need me for anything tomorrow?"
"Not especially. I'll just be working on Quimby's wagon. The blasted frame still won't sit square."
Roran nodded, pleased.
"Good. Then I'll take the day and go hunting. There are a few deer farther down the valley that don't look too scrawny.
Their ribs weren't showing, at least."
Baldur suddenly brightened. "Do you want some company?"
"Sure, we can leave at dawn."
When he finished eating, Roran scrubbed his face and hands clean, then wandered outside to clear his head. Stretching leisurely, he strolled toward the centre of town. Halfway there, the chatter of excited voices outside the Seven Sheaves caught his attention. He turned, curious, and made his way to the tavern, where an odd sight met him. Sitting on the porch was a middle-aged man draped in a patchwork leather coat. Beside him was a pack festooned with the steel jaws of the trapper's trade. Several dozen villagers listened as he gestured expansively and said,
"So when I arrived at Terrensford, I went to this man, Neil. Good, honest man. I help in his fields during the spring and summer."
Roran nodded. Trappers spent the winter squirreled away in the mountains, returning in the spring to sell their skins to tanners like Gedrick, and then to take up work, usually as farmhands. Since Carvajal was the northernmost village in the Spine, many trappers passed through it, which was one of the reasons Carvajal had its own tavern, blacksmith, and tanner.
"After a few steins of ale, to lubricate my speaking, you understand, after a half year with nary a word uttered, except perhaps for blaspheming the world and all beyond when losing a bear-biter, I come to Neil, the froth still fresh on my beard, and started exchanging gossip. As our transaction proceeds, I ask him all gregarious-like, what news of the Empire or the King, may he rot with gangrene and trench-mouth? Was anyone born, or died, or banished, that I should know of? And then, guess what?" Neil leaned forward, going all serious about the mouth, and said that word is going around there is, from Drasleona and Gilead, of strange happenings, here, there, and everywhere in Alagasia.
The Urgles have fair disappeared from civilized lands and good riddance, but not one man can tell why or where. Half the trade in the Empire has dried up as a result of raids and attacks, and from what I heard, it isn't the work of mere brigands, for the attacks are too widespread, too calculated. No goods are stolen, only burned or soiled. But that's not the end of it, oh no, not by the tip of your blessed grandmother's whiskers. The trapper shook his head and took a sip from his wineskin before continuing. There be mutterings of a shade haunting the northern territories. He's been seen along the edge of Duweldenwarden and near Gilead. They say his teeth are filed to points, his eyes are as red as wine, and his hair is as red as the blood he drinks. Worse, something seems to have gotten our fine mad monarch's dander up, so it has. 5 days passed. A juggler from the south stopped in Therensford on his lonesome way to Siunon, and he said that troops had been moving and gathering, though for what was beyond him. He shrugged. As my pap taught me when I was a suckling babe, where there's smoke, there's fire. Perhaps it's the Varden. They've caused old Ironbones enough pain in the arse over the years. Or perhaps Galbatorix finally decided he's had enough of tolerating Surda. At least he knows where to find it, unlike those rebels. He'll crush Surda like a bear crushes an ant, he will. Roran blinked as a babble of questions exploded around the trapper. He was inclined to doubt the report of a shade. It sounded too much like a story a drunk woodsman might invent. But the rest of it all sounded bad enough to be true.
Surda.
Little information reached Carvajal about that distant country. But Roran at least knew that although Surda and the Empire were ostensibly at peace, Surdans lived in constant fear that their more powerful neighbour to the north would invade them. For that reason it was said that Orin, their king, supported the Varden. If the trapper was right about Galbatorix, then it could mean ugly war crouched in the future, accompanied by the hardships of increased taxes and forced conscription. I would rather live in an age devoid of momentous events. Upheaval makes already difficult lives such as ours nigh impossible. What's more, there have even been tales of... Here the trapper paused, and with a knowing expression tapped the side of his nose with his forefinger. Tales of a new rider in Alagasia. He laughed then, a big, hearty laugh, slapping his belly as he rocked back on the porch. Roran laughed as well. Stories of riders appeared every few years. They had excited his interest the first 2 or 3 times, but he soon learned not to trust such accounts, for they all came to naught. The rumours were nothing more than wishful thinking on the part of those who longed for a brighter future. He was about to head off when he noticed Katrina standing by the corner of the tavern, garbed in a long russet dress decorated with green ribbon. She gazed at him with the same intensity with which he gazed at her. Going over, he touched her on the shoulder, and together they slipped away. They walked to the edge of Carvajal, where they stood looking at the stars. The heavens were brilliant, shimmering with thousands of celestial fires, and arching above them from north to south was the glorious pearly band that streamed from horizon to horizon like diamond dust tossed from a pitcher. Without looking at him, Katrina rested her head on Roran's shoulder and asked, "How was your day?" "I returned home." He felt her stiffen against him. "What was it like?" "Terrible." His voice caught and he fell silent, holding her tightly. The scent of her copper hair on his cheek was like an elixir of wine and spice and perfume. It seeped deep inside him, warm and comforting. "The house, the barn, the fields, they're all being overrun. I wouldn't have found them if I didn't know where to look." She finally turned to face him, stars flashing in her eyes, sorrow on her face. "Oh, Roran." She kissed him, lips brushing his for a brief moment. "You have endured so much loss, and yet your strength has never failed you. Will you return to your farm now?" Aye, farming is all I know.
And what shall become of me?
He hesitated. From the moment he began to court her, an unspoken assumption that they would marry had existed between them. There had been no need to discuss his intentions. They were as plain as the day was long, and so her question unsettled him. It also felt improper to address the issue in such an open manner when he was not ready to tender an offer. It was his place to make the overtures, first to Sloane and then to Katrina, not hers. Still, he had to deal with her concern now that it had been expressed.
Katrina, I cannot approach your father as I had planned. He would laugh at me, and rightly so.
We have to wait.
Once I have a place for us to live and I've collected my first harvest, then he will listen to me.
She faced the sky once more and whispered something so faint he could not make it out.
What?
I said, are you afraid of him?
Of course not. Then you must get his permission tomorrow and set the engagement. Make him understand that though you have nothing now, you will give me a good home and be a son-in-law he can be proud of. There's no reason we should waste our years living apart when we feel like this.
I can't do that, he said with a note of despair, willing her to understand.
I can't provide for you. I can't. Don't you understand?
She stepped away, her voice strained with urgency.
I love you, Roran, and I want to be with you. But Father has other plans for me. There are far more eligible men than you, and the longer you delay, the more he presses me to consent to a match of which he approves. He fears I will become an old maid, and I fear that too. I have only so much time or choice in Carvajal. If I must take another, I will.
Tears glistened in her eyes as she gave him a searching glance, waiting for his response, then gathered up her dress and rushed back to the houses. Roran stood there, motionless with shock. Her absence was as acute for him as losing the farm, the world suddenly gone cold and unfriendly. It was as if part of himself had been torn away. It was hours before he could return to Horst's and slip into bed.
The Hunted Hunters. Dirt crunched under Roran's boots as he led the way down the valley, which was cool and pale in the early hours of the overcast morning. Baldur followed close behind, both of them carrying strung bows. Neither spoke as they studied their surroundings for signs of the deer.
There,
said Baldur in a low voice, pointing at a set of tracks leading toward a bramble on the edge of the Anora. Roran nodded and started after the spoor. It looked about a day old, so he risked speaking.
Could I have your advice, Baldur? You seem to have a good understanding of people.
Of course. What is it? For a long time, the pad of their feet was the only noise.
Sloane wants to marry off Katrina, and not to me. Every day that passes increases the chance he will arrange a union to his liking.
What does Katrina say of this? Roran shrugged.
He is her father. She cannot continue to defy his will when no one she does want has stepped forward to claim her.
That is, you.
Aye.
And that's why you were up so early. It was no question. In fact, Roran had been too worried to sleep at all. He had spent the entire night thinking about Katrina, trying to find a solution to their predicament.
I can't bear to lose her. But I don't think Sloane will give us his blessing, what with my position and all.
No, I don't think he would, agreed Baldur. He glanced at Roran out of the corner of his eye. What is it you want my advice on, though? A snort of laughter escaped Roran.
How can I convince Sloane otherwise? How can I resolve this dilemma without starting a blood feud?
He threw his hands up.
What should I do?
Have you no ideas?
I do, but not of a sort I find pleasing. It occurred to me that Katrina and I could simply announce we were engaged, not that we are yet, and hang the consequences. That would force Sloane to accept our betrothal.
A frown creased Baldur's brow. He said carefully, Maybe, but it would also create a slew of bad feelings throughout Carvajal. Few would approve of your actions.
nor would it be wise to force Katrina to choose between you or her family. She might resent you for it in years to come.
I know, but what alternative do I have?
Before you take such a drastic step, I recommend you try to win Sloane over as an ally. There's a chance you might succeed, after all, if it's made clear to him that no one else will want to marry an angry Katrina, especially when you're around to cuckold the husband. Roran grimaced and kept his gaze on the ground. Baldur laughed. If you fail, well then you can proceed with confidence, knowing that you have indeed exhausted all other routes, and people will be less likely to spit upon you for breaking tradition, and more likely to say Sloane's bull-headed ways brought it upon himself.
Neither course is easy.
You knew that to begin with. Baldur grew sombre again. No doubt there'll be harsh words if you challenge Sloane, but things will settle down in the end, perhaps not comfortably, but at least bearably. Aside from Sloane, the only people you'll really offend are prudes like Quimby. Though how Quimby can brew such a hale drink yet be so starched and bitter himself is beyond me. Roran nodded, understanding. Grudges could simmer for years in Carvajal.
I'm glad we could talk. It's been...
He faltered, thinking of all the discussions he and Aragorn used to share. They had been, as Aragorn once said, brothers in all but blood. It had been deeply comforting to know that someone existed who would listen to him, no matter the time or circumstances, and to know that person would always help him, no matter the cost. The absence of such a bond left Roran feeling empty. Baldur did not press him to finish his sentence, but instead stopped to drink from his waterskin. Roran continued for a few yards, then halted as a scent intruded on his thoughts. It was the heavy odour of seared meat and charred pine boughs. Who would be here besides us? Breathing deeply, he turned in a circle, trying to determine the source of the fire. A slight gust brushed past him from farther down the road, carrying a hot, smoky wave. The aroma of food was intense enough to make his mouth water. He beckoned to Baldur, who hurried to his side.
Smell that?
Baldur nodded. Together they returned to the road and followed it south. About 100 feet away, it bent around a copse of cottonwoods and curved out of view. As they approached the turn, the rise and fall of voices reached them, muffled by the thick layer of morning fog over the valley. At the copse's fringe, Roran slowed to a stop. It was foolish to surprise people when they too might be out hunting. Still, something bothered him. Perhaps it was the number of voices. The group seemed bigger than any family in the valley. Without thinking, he stepped off the road and slipped behind the underbrush lining the copse.
"What are you doing?"
whispered Baldur. Roran put a finger to his lips, then crept along parallel to the road, keeping his footsteps as quiet as possible. As they rounded the bend, he froze. On the grass by the road was a camp of soldiers. 30 helmets gleamed in a shaft of morning light as their owners devoured fowl and stew cooked over several fires. The men were mud-splattered and travel-stained, but Galbatorix's symbol was still visible on their red tunics, a twisting flame outlined in gold thread. Underneath the tunics they wore leather brigandines, heavy with riveted squares of steel, mail shirts, and then padded gambesons. Most of the soldiers bore broadswords, though half a dozen were archers, and another half dozen carried wicked-looking halberds. And hunched in their midst were two twisted black forms that Roran recognised from the numerous descriptions the villagers provided upon his return from Therensford. The strangers who had destroyed his farm. His blood chilled.
They're servants of the Empire.
He began to step forward, fingers already reaching for an arrow, when Baldur grabbed his jerkin and dragged him to the ground.
Don't! You'll get us both killed!
Roran glared at him, then snarled.
They're the bastards!
He stopped, noticing that his hands were shaking.
They've returned!
Roran!
Whispered Baldur intently.
You can't do anything. Look, they work for the king. Even if you managed to escape, you'd be an outlaw everywhere, and you'd bring disaster on Carvajal. What do they want? What can they want?
The king.
Why did Galbatorix countenance my father's torture? If they didn't get what they needed from Garrow, and Aragorn fled with Brom, then they must want you. Baldur paused, letting the words sink in. We have to get back and warn everyone. Then you have to hide. The strangers are the only ones with horses. We can get there first if we run. Rohan stared through the brush at the oblivious soldiers. His heart pounded fiercely for revenge, clamouring to attack and fight, to see those two agents of misfortune pierced with arrows and brought to their own justice. It mattered not that he would die, as long as he could wash clean his pain and sorrow in one fell moment. All he had to do was break cover. The rest would take care of itself. Just one small step.
With a choked sob, he clenched his fist and dropped his head.
I can't leave Katrina.
He remained rigid, eyes squeezed shut. Then, with agonizing slowness, dragged himself back.
Home, then.
Without waiting for Baldur's reaction, Rohan slipped through the trees as fast as he dared. Once the camp was out of sight, he broke out onto the road and ran down the dirt track, channeling his frustration, anger, and even fear into speed. Baldur scrambled behind him, gaining on the open stretches. Rohan slowed to a comfortable trot and waited for him to draw level before saying,
"You spread the word. I'll talk with Horst."
Baldur nodded, and they pushed on. After 2 miles, they stopped to drink and rest briefly. When their panting subsided, they continued through the low hills preceding Carvajal. The rolling ground slowed them considerably, but even so, the village soon burst into view. Rohan immediately broke for the forge, leaving Baldur to make his way to the centre of town. As he pounded past the houses, Rohan wildly considered schemes to evade or kill the strangers without incurring the wrath of the Empire. He burst into the forge to catch Horst tapping a peg into the side of Quimby's wagon, singing,
"Hey yo!" And a ringing and a dinging rang from old iron, wily old iron, with a beat and a bang on the bones of the land, I conquered wily old iron.
Horst stopped his mallet in mid-blow when he saw Rohan.
"What's the matter, lad? Is Baldur hurt?"
Rohan shook his head and leaned over, gasping for air. In short bursts, he reiterated all they had seen and its possible implications, most importantly, that it was now clear the strangers were agents of the Empire.
Horst fingered his beard. "You have to leave Carvajal. Fetch some food from the house, then take my mare. Ivor's pulling stumps with her, and ride into the foothills. Once we know what the soldiers want, I'll send Albrecht or Baldur with word."
"What will you say if they ask for me?"
"That you're out hunting, and we don't know when you'll return." "It's true enough, and I doubt they'll chance blundering around in the trees for fear of missing you. Assuming it's you they're really after."
Rohan nodded, then turned and ran to Horst's house. Inside, he grabbed the mare's tack and bags from the wall, quickly tied turnips, beets, jerky and a loaf of bread in a knot of blankets, snatched up a tin pot and dashed out, pausing only long enough to explain the situation to Elaine. The supplies were an awkward bundle in his arms as he jogged east from Carvajal to Ivor's farm. Ivor himself stood behind the farmhouse, flicking the mare with a willow wand as she strained to tear the hairy roots of an elm tree from the ground.
"Come on now," shouted the farmer. "Put your back into it."
The horse shuddered with effort, her bit lathered, then with a final surge tilted the stump on its side so the roots reached toward the sky like a cluster of gnarled fingers. Ivor stopped her exertion with a twitch of the reins and patted her good-naturedly.
"All right, there we go."
Rohan hailed him from a distance, and when they were close, pointed to the horse.
"I need to borrow her."
He gave his reasons. Ivor swore and began unhitching the mare, grumbling.
"Always a moment I get a bit of work done, less when the interruption comes, never before."
He crossed his arms and frowned as Rohan cinched the saddle, intent on his work. When he was ready, Rohan swung onto the horse, bow in hand.
"I'm sorry for the trouble, but it can't be helped."
"Well, don't worry about it. Just make sure you aren't caught."
"I'll do that."
As he set heels to the mare's sides, Roran heard Ivor call, "And don't be hiding up my creek!" Roran grinned and shook his head, bending low over the horse's neck. He soon reached the foothills of the spine and worked his way up to the mountains that formed the north end of Palancar Valley. From there, he climbed to a point on the mountainside where he could observe Carvajal without being seen. Then he picketed his steed and settled down to wait. Roran shivered, eyeing the dark pines. He disliked being this close to the spine. Hardly anyone from Carvajal dared set foot in the mountain range, and those who did often failed to return. Before long, Roran saw the soldiers march up the road in a double line, two ominous black figures at their head. They were stopped at the edge of Carvajal by a ragged group of men, some of them with picks in hand. The two sides spoke, then simply faced each other, like growling dogs waiting to see who would strike first. After a long moment, the men of Carvajal moved aside and let the intruders pass.
"What happens now?" wondered Roran, rocking back on his heels.
By evening, the soldiers had set up camp in a field adjacent to the village. Their tents formed a low grey block that flickered with weird shadows as sentries patrolled the perimeter. In the centre of the block, a large fire sent billows of smoke into the air. Roran had made his own camp, and now he simply watched and thought. He always assumed that when the strangers destroyed his home, they got what they wanted, which was the stone Aragorn brought from the spine. They must not have found it, he decided. Perhaps Aragorn managed to escape with the stone. Perhaps he felt that he had to leave in order to protect it. He frowned. That would go a long way toward explaining why Aragorn fled, but it still seemed far-fetched to Roran. Whatever the reason, that stone must be a fantastic treasure for the king to send so many men to retrieve it. I can't understand what would make it so valuable. Maybe it's magic. He breathed deeply of the cool air, listening to the hoot of an owl. A flicker of movement caught his attention. Glancing down the mountain, he saw a man approaching in the forest below. Roran ducked behind a boulder, bow drawn. He waited until he was sure it was Albrecht, then whistled softly. Albrecht soon arrived at the boulder. On his back was an overfull pack, which he dropped to the ground with a grunt.
"I thought I'd never find you."
"I'm surprised you did.
Can't say I enjoyed wandering through the forest after sundown. I kept expecting to walk into a bear, or worse. The spine isn't a fit place for men, if you ask me."
Roran looked back out at Carvajal. "So why are they here?"
"To take you into custody. They're willing to wait as long as they have to for you to return from hunting."
Roran sat with a hard thump, his gut clenched with cold anticipation.
"Did they give a reason? Did they mention the stone?"
Albrecht shook his head.
"All they would say is that it's the king's business. The whole day they've been asking questions about you and Aragorn. It's all they're interested in."
He hesitated.
"I'd stay, but they'll notice if I'm missing tomorrow. I brought plenty of food and blankets, plus some of Gertrude's salves in case you injure yourself. You should be fine up here."
Summoning his energy, Roran smiled. "Thanks for the help."
"Anyone would do it," said Albrecht, with an embarrassed shrug.
He started to leave, then tossed over his shoulder.
"By the way, the two strangers, they're called the Razak."
Saphira's Promise. The morning after meeting with the Council of Elders, Aragorn was cleaning and oiling Saphira's saddle, careful not to overexert himself, when Auric came to visit. The dwarf waited until Aragorn finished with a strap, then asked,
"Are you better today?"
"A little."
"Good. We all need our strength. I came partly to see to your health, and also because Hrothgar wishes to speak with you, if you are free."
Aragorn gave the dwarf a wry smile.
"I'm always free for him. He must know that."
Auric laughed.
"Ah, but it's polite to ask nicely."
As Aragorn put down the saddle, Saphira uncoiled from her padded corner and greeted Auric with a friendly growl.
"Morning to you as well,"
he said with a bow. Auric led them through one of Trondheim's four main corridors towards its central chamber and the two mirroring staircases that curved underground to the Dwarf King's throne room. Before they reached the chamber, however, he turned down a small flight of stairs. It took Aragorn a moment to realize that Auric had taken a side passageway to avoid seeing the wreckage of Isidar Mithrim. They came to a stop before the granite doors engraved with a seven-pointed crown. Seven armoured dwarves on each side of the entrance pounded the floor simultaneously with the hafts of their mattocks. With the echoing thud of wood on stone, the doors swung inward. Aragorn nodded to Auric, then entered the dim room with Saphira. They advanced toward the distant throne, passing the rigid statues, Hyrna, of past dwarf kings. At the foot of the heavy black throne, Aragorn bowed. The dwarf king inclined his silver-maned head in return, the rubies wrought into his golden helm glowing dully in the light like flecks of hot iron. Volund, the warhammer, lay across his mail-sheathed legs. Hrothgar spoke.
"Shadeslayer, welcome to my hall. You have done much since last we met, and so it seems I have been proved wrong about Zarok. Morzan's blade will be welcome in Trondheim as long as you bear it."
"Thank you," said Aragorn, rising.
"Also," rumbled the dwarf, "we wish you to keep the armor you wore in the Battle of Fardandur. Even now our most skilled smiths are repairing it. The dragon armor is being treated likewise, and when it is restored, Saphira may use it as long as she wishes, or until she outgrows it. This is the least we can do to show our gratitude. If it weren't for the war with Galbatorix, there would be feasts and celebrations in your name. But those must wait until a more appropriate time."
Voicing both his and Saphira's sentiment, Aragorn said, "You are generous beyond all expectations. We will cherish such noble gifts." Clearly pleased, Hrothgar nevertheless scowled, bringing his snarled eyebrows together.
"We cannot linger on pleasantries, though. I am besieged by the clans with demands that I do one thing or another about Arjihad's successor. When the Council of Elders proclaimed yesterday that they would support Nasuada, it created an uproar the likes of which I haven't seen since I ascended to the throne. The chiefs had to decide whether to accept Nasuada or look for another candidate. Most have concluded that Nasuada should lead the Varden, but I wish to know where you stand on this, Aragorn, before I lend my word to either side. The worst thing a king can do is look foolish."
"How much can we tell him?" Aragorn asked Saphira, thinking quickly.
"He's always treated us fairly. But we can't know what he may have promised other people. We'd best be cautious until Nasuada actually takes power."
"Very well. Saphira and I have agreed to help her. We won't oppose her ascension, and..." Aragorn wondered if he was going too far. "I plead that you do the same. The Varden can't afford to fight among themselves. They need unity."
"Away," said Hrothgar, leaning back. "You speak with new authority. Your suggestion is a good one, but it will cost a question. Do you think Nasuada will be a wise leader, or are there other motives in choosing her?"
"It's a test,"
warned Saphira.
"He wants to know why we've backed her."
Aragorn felt his lips twitch in a half-smile. "I think her wise and canny beyond her years. She will be good for the Varden."
"And that is why you support her?"
"Yes." Hrothgar nodded, dipping his long, snowy beard.
"That relieves me. There has been too little concern lately with what is right and good, and more about what will bring individual power. It is hard to watch such idiocy and not be angry."
An uncomfortable silence fell between them, stifling in the long throne room. To break it, Aragorn asked, "What will be done with the Dragonhold? Will a new floor be laid down?" For the first time, the king's eyes grew mournful, deepening the surrounding lines that splayed like spokes on a wagon wheel. It was the closest Aragorn had ever seen a dwarf come to weeping.
"Much talk is needed before that step can be taken. It was a terrible deed what Saphira and Arya did. Maybe necessary, but terrible. Ah, it might have been better if the Urgals had overrun us before Isidar Mithram was ever broken. The heart of Trondheim has been shattered, and so has ours."
Hrothgar placed his fist over his breast, then slowly unclenched his hand and reached down to grasp Volan's leather-wrapped handle. Saphira touched Aragorn's mind. He sensed several emotions in her, but what surprised him the most was her remorse and guilt. She truly regretted the Star Rose's demise, despite the fact that it had been required.
"Little one," she said, "help me. I need to speak with Hrothgar. Ask him, do the dwarves have the ability to reconstruct Isidar Mithram out of the shards?"
As he repeated the words, Hrothgar muttered something in his own language, then said,
"The skill we have, but what of it? The task would take months or years, and the end result would be a ruined mockery of the beauty that once graced Trondheim. It is an abomination I will not sanction."
Saphira continued to stare unblinkingly at the king.
"Now tell him, if Isidar Mithrim were put together again, with not one piece missing, I believe I could make it whole once more."
Aragorn gaped at her, forgetting Hrothgar in his astonishment.
"Saphira, the energy that would require! You told me yourself that you can't use magic at will, so what makes you sure you can do this?"
"I can do it if the need is great enough. It will be my gift to the dwarves. Remember Brom's tomb. Let that wash your doubt away. And close your mouth. It's unbecoming, and the king is watching."
When Aragorn conveyed Saphira's offer, Hrothgar straightened with an exclamation.
"Is it possible? Not even the elves might attempt such a feat."
"She is confident in her abilities."
"Then we will rebuild Isidar Mithrim, no matter if it takes 100 years. We will assemble a frame for the gem and set each piece into its original place. Not a single chip will be forgotten. Even if we must break the larger pieces to move them, it will be done with all our skill in working stone, so that no dust or flecks are lost. You will come, then, when we are finished, and heal the Star Rose."
"We will come," agreed Aragorn, bowing. Hrothgar smiled, and it was like the cracking of a granite wall.
"Such joy you have given me, Saphira. I feel once more a reason to rule and live. If you do this, dwarves everywhere will honor your name for uncounted generations. Go now with my blessings while I spread the tidings among the clans, and do not feel bound to wait upon my announcement, for no dwarf should be denied this news. Convey it to all whom you meet. May the halls echo with the jubilation of our race."
With one more bow, Aragorn and Saphira departed, leaving the dwarf king still smiling on his throne. Out of the hall, Aragorn told Oric what had transpired. The dwarf immediately bent and kissed the floor before Saphira. He rose with a grin and clasped Aragorn's arm, saying,
"A wonder indeed! You have given us exactly the hope we needed to combat recent events. There will be drinking tonight, I wager."
"And tomorrow is the funeral." Oric sobered for a moment.
"Tomorrow, yes. but until then we shall not let unhappy thoughts disturb us. Come."
Taking Aragorn's hand, the dwarf pulled him through Trondheim to a great feast hall where many dwarves sat at stone tables. Auric leaped onto one, scattering dishes across the floor, and in a booming voice proclaimed the news of Isidar Mithrim. Aragorn was nearly deafened by the cheers and shouts that followed. Each of the dwarves insisted on coming to Saphira and kissing the floor as Auric had. When that was finished, they abandoned their food and filled their stone tankards with beer and mead. Aragorn joined the revelry with an abandon that surprised him. It helped to ease the melancholy gathered in his heart. However, he did try to resist complete debauchery, for he was conscious of the duties that awaited them the following day, and he wanted to have a clear head. Even Saphira took a sip of mead, and finding that she liked it, the dwarves rolled out a whole barrel for her. Delicately lowering her mighty jaws through the cask's open end, she drained it with three long draughts, then tilted her head toward the ceiling and belched a giant tongue of flame. It took several minutes for Aragorn to convince the dwarves that it was safe to approach her again, but once he did, they brought her another barrel, overriding the cook's protests, and watched with amazement as she emptied it as well. As Saphira became increasingly inebriated, her emotions and thoughts washed through Aragorn with more and more force. It became difficult for him to rely upon the input of his own senses. Her vision began to slip over his own, blurring movement and changing colours. Even the odours he smelled shifted at times, becoming sharper, more pungent. The dwarves began to sing together. Weaving as she stood, Saphira hummed along, punctuating each line with a roar. Aragorn opened his mouth to join in and was shocked when, instead of words, out came the snarling rasp of a dragon's voice. "That," he thought, shaking his head, "is going too far. Or am I just drunk?" He decided it did not matter and proceeded to sing boisterously, dragon's voice or not. Dwarves continued to stream into the hall as word of Isidar Mithrim spread. Hundreds soon packed the tables with a thick ring around Aragorn and Saphira. Auric called in musicians who arranged themselves in a corner where they pulled slipcovers of green velvet off their instruments. Soon harps, lutes and silver flutes floated their gilded melodies over the throng. Many hours passed before the noise and excitement began to calm. When it did, Auric once more climbed onto the table. He stood there, legs spread wide for balance, tankard in hand, iron-bound cap awry, and cried,
"Hear, hear! At last we have celebrated as is proper. The Urgals are gone, the shade is dead, and we have won!"
The dwarves all pounded their tables in approval. It was a good speech, short and to the point. But Auric was not finished.
"To Aragorn and Saphira," he roared, lifting the tankard.
This, too, was well received. Aragorn stood and bowed, which brought more cheers. Beside him, Saphira reared and swung a foreleg across her chest, attempting to duplicate his move. She tottered, and the dwarves, realizing their danger, scrambled away from her. They were barely in time. With a loud whoosh, Saphira fell backward, landing flat on a banquet table. Pain shot through Aragorn's back, and he collapsed insensate by her tail. Requiem.
"Wake, Norlheim. You cannot sleep now. We are needed at the gate. They won't start without us."
Aragorn forced his eyes open, conscious of an aching head and sore body. He was lying on a cold stone table. "What?" He grimaced at the sick taste on his tongue. Auric tugged on his brown beard.
"Arjihad's procession. We must be present for it."
"No. What did you call me?" They were still in the banquet hall, but it was empty except for him, Auric and Saphira, who lay on her side between two tables. She stirred and lifted her head, looking around with bleary eyes.
Stonehead. I called you Stonehead because I've been trying to wake you for almost an hour.
Aragorn pushed himself upright and slid off the table. Flashes of memory from the night before jumped through his mind.
Saphira, how are you?
He asked, stumbling to her. She swiveled her head, running her crimson tongue in and out over her teeth like a cat that ate something unpleasant.
Whole, I think. My left wing feels a bit strange. I think it's the one I landed on. And my head is filled with a thousand hot arrows.
Was anyone hurt when she fell?
Asked Aragorn, concerned. A hearty chuckle exploded from the dwarf's thick chest.
Only those who dropped off their seats from laughing so hard. A dragon getting drunk and bowing at that. I'm sure lays will be sung about it for decades.
Saphira shuffled her wings and looked away primly.
We thought it best to leave you here, since we couldn't move you, Saphira. It upset the head cook terribly. He feared you would drink more of his best stock than the 4 barrels you already did.
And you chastised me once for drinking. If I consumed 4 barrels, it would kill me.
That's why you're not a dragon.
Oric thrust a bundle of clothes into Aragorn's arms.
Here, put these on. They are more appropriate for a funeral than your own attire. But hurry, we have little time.
Aragorn struggled into the items. A billowy white shirt with ties at the cuffs, a red vest decorated with gold braiding and embroidery, dark pants, shiny black boots that clacked on the floor, and a swirling cape that fastened under his throat with a studded brooch. In place of the usual plain leather band, Zarok was fastened to an ornate belt. Aragorn splashed his face with water and tried to arrange his hair neatly. Then Oric rushed him and Saphira out of the hall and toward Tronchim's south gate.
We must start from there,
he explained, moving with surprising speed on his stocky legs.
Because that is where the procession with Azjihad's body stopped 3 days ago. His journey to the grave cannot be interrupted, or else his spirit will find no rest.
An odd custom, remarked Saphira.
Aragorn agreed, noting a slight unsteadiness in her gait. In Carvajal, people were usually buried on their farm, or if they lived in the village, in a small graveyard. The only rituals that accompanied the process were lines recited from certain ballads and a death feast held afterward for relatives and friends.
Can you make it through the whole funeral? He asked, as Saphira staggered again.
She grimaced briefly.
That and Nasuada's appointment, but then I'll need to sleep. A pox on all mead.
Returning to his conversation with Oric, Aragorn asked, Where will Azjihad be buried? Oric slowed and glanced at Aragorn with caution.
That has been a matter of contention among the clans. When a dwarf dies, we believe he must be sealed in stone, or else he will never join his ancestors. It is complex, and I cannot say more to an outsider, but we go to great lengths to assure such a burial. Shame falls on a family or clan if they allow any of their own to lie in a lesser element. Under Farthendur exists a chamber that is the home of all Nurlan, all dwarves who have died here. It is there Azjihad will be taken. He cannot be entombed with us as he is human, but a hallowed alcove has been set aside for him. There the Varden may visit him without disturbing our sacred grottos, and Azjihad will receive the respect he is due.
Your king has done much for the Varden, commented Aragorn.
Some think too much.
Before the thick gate, drawn up on its hidden chains to reveal faint daylight drifting into Farthendur, they found a carefully arranged column. Azjihad lay at the front, cold and pale on a white marble bier borne by 6 men in black armour. Upon his head was a helm strewn with precious stones,
His hands were clasped beneath his collarbone, over the ivory hilt of his bare sword, which extended from underneath the shield covering his chest and legs.